I wanted to start with just a quick introduction about ayahuasca, just in case there's anyone here who doesn't know what it is. This is the process of preparing ayahuasca. This is the ayahuasca vine, which is beaten to a pulp and then cut up into pieces and then boiled with the jacaruna leaf. Now, the ayahuasca vine contains a monoamine oxidase inhibitor, and the jacaruna leaf contains DMT. DMT is a powerful psychedelic, which generally isn't orally active, but in combination with the monoamine oxidase inhibitor in the ayahuasca vine, it becomes very powerfully orally active. So these two ingredients are boiled into a brew that becomes a very thick liquid and tastes quite horrible, but produces a five-hour-long experience, psychedelic experience. Now, the context here ayahuasca is used in many different contexts. The context that I'm focusing on here is the medicinal use of ayahuasca within the broader discipline of Amazonian plant medicine. So in this context, it is very much seen as medicine, not as some recreational drug experience. So that's the context that I want to focus on. Okay, so this statement from Donna Haraway is in the abstract, and you've all read it. I just want to go to the one below, which is kind of one of the guiding principles in the paper here. And Donna Haraway says it has become literally unthinkable to do good work in any interesting field with the premises of individualism, methodological individualism, and human exceptionalism. So one of the things I'm thinking about is how we can think through and with bacterial evolution to get around some of the problems of human exceptionalism. All right. So as I said, Lynn Margulis is a huge part of this paper. She unfortunately died in 2011, but she's left us some amazing work on evolutionary theory, but also on symbiosis and symbiogenesis. She wrote a number of books with her son, Dorian Sagan, a child who she had with Carl Sagan. So a bit of a scientific power couple, I guess they were, back in the day. So a lot of the material that I'm going to go through here is drawing on the books that she wrote, particularly with her son. She's both a thinker and a scientist, and I think it's important to realise that she was engaged in both of those realms. Okay, so we'll come to this quote in a moment. All right, the idea that a recognition and cultivation of cultural and biological diversity is a key principle in living ethically on this planet was perhaps the most powerful lesson that I took away from my first experience with ayahuasca. This lesson was accompanied by dazzling patterns of light and colour that seemed to illustrate this underlying ethics of life. DMT, one of the active ingredients in the ayahuasca brew, is considered a powerful hallucinogen, but the patterns that I witnessed during my first encounter with ayahuasca seemed to be more than mere hallucinations. They had a clear didactic function in illustrating an ethics of diversity. There was a clear sense that I was like a kid in a class being taught some basic lessons about life. The experience felt entirely consistent with the ideas expressed by practitioners of Amazonian plant medicine that ayahuasca and other plants that are part of the discipline are plant teachers. At this point, I might continue with a general valorizing of ayahuasca experiences and try and convince you that they have some inherent value. But this would be to ignore the variety and cultural complexities surrounding different uses of ayahuasca and would very likely fall into New Age cliches. Instead, I follow author and anthropologist Jeremy Narby's lead by suggesting that the value of the psychedelic insight is not to be found in the experience itself, but in the quality of the work it produces. This talk is just the beginning of that work. The task to articulate an ethics of diversity from the point of view of art and biology
the task is to articulate an ethics of diversity from the point of view of art and biology that might function as part of an ecology of knowledges that includes non-Western and non-human epistemologies. An ecology in which science, in which the science of microbial evolution, thinking through and with art, and the ways of knowing implicit in Amazonian plant medicine might occupy a common space that recognises the conditions of knowledge creation in each of these disciplines and the parallels and productive differentiation that exists between them. The notion that productive differentiation is an important dynamic in producing diversity is one that I draw from the history of evolution and the principles and trajectories that link prototaxis, symbiosis, and symbiogenesis. But it is also an ethical principle that might guide encounters between very different knowledge systems and cultural practices. The hope is that recognizing autonomous differentiated functioning in biological and cultural systems might help to immunize us against human exceptionalism and universalism, and therefore help to provide us with a means to articulate a meaningful ethics of diversity. We can find these trajectories in the book Acquiring Genomes by Lynn Margulis and Dorian Sagan. In this book, the authors argue that the symbiogenic fusing... In this book, the authors argue that the symbiogenic fusing of previously separate organisms is a major source of evolutionary novelty. In order to answer the question of how individual organisms fuse to form new individuals, Margulis and Sagan articulate a number of stages in the movement towards symbiosis. The first stage is articulated by Ivan Emanuel Wallen, who developed a theory of prototaxis to answer his question of how these tightly integrated symbiosis could ever begin in the first place. Prototaxis, Wallen proffered, preceded symbiosis in any association of more than a single type of life. By prototaxis, Wallen meant the innate tendency of one cell or organism to respond in a specific manner to another. Examples include the tendencies of the mouse to flee from the cat, the shark to swallow the fish, the rabbit to dine on the lettuce, or the fly to lay its eggs on the bloody, exposed muscle tissue of a recently dead boar. Prototaxis, as these examples show, may be negative or positive, associating or disassociating. For Margulis and Sagan, the behaviours that link organisms, prototactical behaviours, are the first and most superficial stage of integrated symbiotic partnerships. But before organisms are associated behaviourally, they may simply be drawn into a common space and exist in loose associations that are based on proximity and the sensing of others and difference. Particular environments, waterholes, treetops, caves, exert prototactical pulls that draw organisms together in specific ways. Once organisms occupy a common space, the loosest form of behavioural association might simply be the awareness of another organism. From there, more intimate behavioural associations might lead to various kinds of connections between organisms. Some stable symbiotic partnerships are integrated only at the behavioural level. Many, however, proceed to more intimate levels of integration, from behavioural to metabolic. Frequently, the metabolic product, the exudate or waste of one partner, becomes the food of the other. Metabolic symbiotic relationships can become gene product associations and finally integrations at the genetic level, when genes from one organism become integrated into the genes of another. The authors describe a number of organisms that exemplify the various stages of symbiotic integration. One of the examples they give is of behavioural integration is a type of starfish that attracts a particular species of black worm to live around its mouth. In this case, prototaxis involves substances produced by the starfish that cause the worms to respond in a specific manner. The worms are drawn by these substances towards the mouth of the starfish, where they provide oral hygiene services for the starfish. While the starfish will generally eat almost anything, including close relatives of these worms, the worms that live around it never eats its behavioural symbionts, the worms living around its mouth. Like the worms, that are drawn to the mouth of the starfish, Prototaxis initiates a movement, an approach, a coming together, or a fleeing, as in the case of the mouse from the cat, a communion, an active living together, a common habit, like the biologist who imitates the plant by sitting very still for hours in order to study it. One organism, Prototaxis, involves common time. One organism slowing down or speeding up in response to another, and common space, the way that organisms flood in to fill the gaps, including those between the teeth, created by other organisms. On this level, prototaxis can be seen as a kind of productive constraint. It constrains the direction and speed of an organism's movement in relation to predators and symbionts. It can also provide spatial constraints for an organism's growth and viability. The worms in the starfish's mouth can only grow to a certain size, while the range of an organism is limited by its prototactical relationships with other organisms. We can put this in slightly different terms with the following quote from Margulis and Sagan's What is Life? Life is evolutionary exuberance. It is what happens when expanding populations of active sensing beings knock up against each other and work things out. In this way, prototactical relationships we can see something of the dynamics of diversity. It is the process of sensing and working out that produces biological and cultural diversity. As Margulis and Sagan point out, the sensing and working out can take the form of predation, but predation must always be tempered. A ruthless predator that kills all its prey will wipe itself out. And as we'll see, even predator-prey relationships can lead to the deepest level of symbiosis, the symbiogenic fusing of predator and prey. But a more important dynamic that emerges from prototaxis and the way that expanding populations of sensing organisms work things out is through symbiotic relationships and the symbiogenic fusing of smaller organisms into larger ones. As we'll see, all multicellular life is the result of fusions between previously free-living organisms. I'll return to the trajectories of prototaxis a little later. Suffice to say at this point that the coming together that is prototaxis can initiate processes of simultaneous differentiation and integration that continue right up to the symbiogenic fusing of organisms. It is in this sense that the dynamics of productive differentiation and integration that I see the encounter of the forms of knowledge that constitute this paper. The task here is to imagine what prototaxis might be at the level of thought, a task itself motivated by a broader project of thinking through and with the implications of biological complexity to develop ethical understandings of human culture and knowledge. This project will hopefully help us to move beyond Richard Dawkins' rather impoverished gene-centric view of biology and its extrapolation to a meme-centric view of culture. An understanding of prototaxis, symbiosis, and microbial evolution can help us to reimagine an ethics of diversity in biology, thought, and culture. Okay, so now we'll come to ayahuasca. And this is from an interview that Michael Taussig gave on the subject. A certain level of bawdiness, of rascal humour, passions about murder, fears of being killed or wanting to kill while taking ayahuasca, all of that sort of stuff seems so far removed from our experience. This mixture of pragmatic everyday, even economic interests, with, I think, a sort of poetry and ecstasy, that's what's so hard in the West, or at least for me, to tinker with, to figure out. Because I immediately tend to dichotomize. Because I immediately tend to dichotomize and ask how these two aspects can coexist. But that's the only way I can get the problem across to myself or to you. A philosophical problem, if you like. A problem of interpretation. This quote from Michael Taussig points to some of the many dimensions in the problem of interpreting ayahuasca experiences from the point of view of Western culture and knowledge. I think Taussig rightly identifies the difficulty of the problem And while I'm not proposing solutions, I do want to suggest that there might be productive ways to approach the problem. Part of the problem that Taussig identifies is our tendency to dichotomize and reduce phenomena to rational categories. The need to make clear distinctions between reality and illusion is part of the dichotomizing impulse. In working toward an ethical and productive approach to the problem of interpretation, I suggest that a more nuanced view is required. On a broader philosophical level, the distinction between what is real and what is not is perhaps less important than the divergent thinking that ayahuasca might facilitate. On this level, the following comment from Brian Massumi regarding his approach to interpreting Deleuze and Guattari is useful. The question is not, is it true, but does it work? What new thoughts does it make possible to think? What new emotions does it make possible to feel? What new sensations and perceptions open up in the body? Experiences with ayahuasca can certainly bring new thoughts and feelings. And according to Taussig, ayahuasca might even be thought of as opening a new sense organ. With this in mind, in order to learn to think, sense, and perceive the full novelty of the ayahuasca experience, it is necessary not so much to suspend disbelief, but to suspend the real. Here I think it's useful to work with an idea that emerges out of a dialogue between Isabel Stengers and Donna Haraway. In response to Stengers, Haraway suggests that to ask what is really real is the devouring monster to which we are all addicted. Stengers gives the example of the Higgs boson that, from the point of view of positivistic science, is now really real, suggesting perhaps that prior to its discovery at the Large Hadron Collider, it existed in some other category of reality. In response to Isabel Stengers, Donna Haraway emphasises the importance of not making pronouncements on what is really real. Haraway tells us that the pronouncement of what exists and what does not exist, or what is truth and illusion, is intimately bound up with the operations of eradication. For Haraway, this includes the eradication of peoples and ideas. I'd like to suggest that we might displace the devouring monster of the really real with many conceptions of the real that highlight the process of producing the real rather than attempting to establish its objective existence. Amongst these conceptions, we might think of the suspended real not as something that is held up and that therefore can be torn down, but as a way of recognising that realities exist as a kind of suspension. That is, they exist in a liquid. There is a liquid in which these instances of the real float, a liquid that gives those instances their consistency. We might also think of the lived real, a conception that emphasises the processes and practices of inhabiting, of living in, that produce particular realities. We might talk about species of the real, that evolve out of particular ecologies and practices. By thinking about the lived real or the suspended real or species of the real, we can ask questions about the materiality of the suspension and practices of inhabiting that are just as relevant to positivistic science as they are to the reality of the ayahuasca experience. This is to affirm that every real is a product of its suspension and its practices of inhabiting, that the apparatus and practices by which we come to know can never be separated from the knowledge that we gain. The Higgs boson is a reality suspended in the highly specialized technology of the Large Hadron Collider and the practices of particle physics, in the same way that the reality of healing spirits of the curanderos in the Amazon is suspended in practices associated with a particular use of ayahuasca within the broader discipline of Amazonian plant medicine. Suggesting that every real is a suspended and lived real, that it is floating in material and practice from which it cannot be separated, is to think about the materiality and practice that give particular realities their consistency. For this reason, it's not useful to describe ayahuasca in either transcendental or immaterial terms. Descriptions that seem to me to be antithetical to the task of understanding and interpreting the materials and practices that produce the ayahuasca experience. I think a more productive approach is to attempt to address the radical materiality that we are engaging with when we experience other realms and encounter healing spirits and intelligence. We can do this through the profound multisensory impressions made by these encounters, which offer us the means to materially interrogate the substance of our ayahuasca experiences. A radical materialist approach to ayahuasca allows us to think about what kind of suspension we are in during the ayahuasca ceremony. This isn't cultural relativism, but rather an acknowledgement that the distinctions and differentiations that exist in each form of knowledge are crucial in producing particular realities. Indeed, there are important distinctions between what is real and what is illusion within ayahuasca's use by various Amazonian groups. These distinctions are aspects of what gives the realities that we can... These distinctions are aspects of what gives the realities that we can access with ayahuasca their consistency. As Stephen Bayer points out in Singing to the Plants, a guide to mestizo shamanism in the Upper Amazon, curanderos make a distinction between the reality of encounters with certain spirits and other visions that may be colourful and compelling, but that are somewhat less important. Bayer suggests that there are three phases in the phenomenology of the ayahuasca experience. The first is a largely visual phase of rapidly changing patterns of colour that might include images of plants and animals. He tells us that these visions aren't of any great interest to the various Amazonian groups who work with ayahuasca. They are not the spirits and are not the Sharanahua say of any importance. The spirits come only by singing and therefore appear only to one who knows the songs that call them. Crucially, the Sharanahua not only discern the real amongst the plurality of possible experiences with ayahuasca, but also have a method in the form of specific songs for reliably accessing the reality of the spirit realm. Bayer then tells us that for the Piro people, the ayahuasca experience begins with the sound of wind rushing through the jungle, followed by what they call the little lights glittering in the dark. It is only after this that the spirits arrive, singing. These spirits, they say, are the real vision. Once again, song is crucial to producing real encounters with the spirit realm. The Shipibo also connect their songs with the reality of their encounters with healing spirits.
Songs that are in turn related to particular patterned visions of healing. Another quote from Singing to the Plants. Among the Shipibo, the designs on their bodies, homes, boats, tools, household goods, and clothing represent sacred patterns derived from a cosmic anaconda whose skin embodies all possible designs. The Shipibo shaman, after drinking ayahuasca, sees such a luminous design in the air. When the design floats down and touches the shaman's lips, it becomes transformed into a song the shaman sings. Different elements of the song resonate to different elements of the design. For example, the end of each verse is associated with the end curl design motif. The shaman sings, "I see brilliant bands of designs curved and fragrant, a synesthesia of sound, vision, and smell." Shipibo shamans employ patterns to reorder the bodies of persons who are ill. Certain diseases are thought to be caused by harmful designs that the shaman must magically unravel and replace with orderly designs. The shaman's song penetrates and reorders the patient's body in the form of harmonious geometric designs. At first, the sick body appears like a very messy design. After a few treatments, the design appears gradually. When the patient is cured, the design is clear, neat, and complete. So these descriptions of the use of song and pattern in Amazonian plant medicine resonate with the second ayahuasca experience that I had, and certainly I saw some of these patterns and these designs being corrected. I interpreted them as kind of fixing a kind of DNA fixing scenario. We'll continue. This distinction between the reality of encounters with healing spirits accessed through song and designs and the somewhat less real little lights is part of a broader linguistic, cultural, and cosmological framework, part of the knowledge and practices that produce the real of ayahuasca experiences and that can help us to both navigate our encounters with other beings and to productively interpret those experiences. There are obviously still profound challenges in these experiences for fundamentalist, rationalist, and monotheistic religious beliefs. However, the problem of interpretation that I'm articulating here is in many ways more tractable than grasping fundamentalist beliefs. This is because the ayahuasca experience is open to analysis and interpretation through a radical form of empiricism. Unlike the vagaries of simple faith, with ayahuasca we are able to test our interpretation socially with others who have experienced similar phenomena. We can make distinctions and differentiations on the basis of these discussions, and we can build a consensus on the reality of certain types of encounters, just as many Amazonian groups have done. It is also important to note that the use of ayahuasca by curanderos in the Amazon is part of a broader practice of Amazonian plant medicine that is itself a kind of radical empiricist discipline in the study of plants. One of the key practices involves living alone in a basic jungle hut, eating a diet consisting of only plantains or two or three other foods, whilst consuming medicinal plants to study their effects on the body and consciousness. This is a means to listen to the plants, to get to know their spirits, and to learn their languages, medicinal uses, and songs. We can think of this discipline as a multifaceted and intimate form of prototaxis. It involves the study of how one organism, humans, respond in a specific manner and under specific circumstances to another organism in the form of the plant that is being ingested. The interaction between plant and curandero is not simply behavioural, but rather operates across levels of biology, physiology, consciousness, and art in the form of the songs of the plants. The prototactical discipline in the study of medicinal plants is another important aspect in the practices and processes of inhabiting that constitute the reality of ayahuasca experiences. At this point, I want to return to the subject of prototactical intelligence in the evolution of life. The idea here is prototactical relational and social intelligence that is less... The idea here is prototactical relational and social intelligence that is less about the individual thinking subject and more to be found in how organisms sense and respond to environmental factors and to one another. This relational or social intelligence is central to the ethics of diversity that I'm articulating here. As part of our inoculation against human exceptionalism, it seems useful to make the argument that we can find this sort of intelligence operating in all forms of life and perhaps even in prebiotic dissipative structures. In order to make this argument, I draw on the account of the genesis of life that we find in microcosmos, 4 billion years of microbial evolution by Margulis and Sagan. Margulis and Sagan suggest that the first stage in the slow brewing of life from non-life were what the Belgian Nobel Prize winning physicist Ilya Prigogier has termed dissipative structures, objects or processes that organise themselves spontaneously change their form. With an influx of energy, dissipative structures may become more instead of less organised. In dissipative structures, information begins to organise itself and pockets of elaboration arise. So these two are examples of dissipative structures. The one on the left is, I believe, caused by a heat gradient, and the one on the right is an autocatalytic chemical process that's produced these patterns. So these dissipative structures emerge in response to energy or chemical gradients that can be defined in general terms as difference across a distance. Crucially, dissipative structures and all autopoietic life are, in thermodynamic terms, open systems, material systems in which mass or energy can be lost or gained from the environment.
One of the key gradients that produce dissipative structures on our planet is the temperature difference created by the sun between the warm surface of the Earth and the coldness of space. Dissipative structures can be understood as as a prebiotic sensing of difference. In this way, we can think of them as the first condition in the emergence of intelligence. Perhaps, in its most general sense, intelligence can be defined as the capacity to sense difference and transform energy into a useful and generative order that might expand and become more complex in space and time. We can trace this developing intelligence from dissipative structures that use difference to turn energy into order, to autopoietic structures capable of using energy to actively and successfully maintain themselves in the face of serious external perturbations. The emergence of DNA and RNA not only established the universal language of life, but also gave the first single cellular life a particularly powerful autopoietic tool. The DNA and RNA molecule can replicate itself exactly, but it can also cause the uniform assembly of those long biochemicals, proteins. Through DNA and RNA base pairs, organisms were able to function as a more complex class of open systems by using materials and energies from the environment to produce in an autopoietic fashion and to reproduce in an autopoietic fashion and to produce the proteins that make an organism what it is. The combination of DNA and RNA allowed for both the capacity to conserve genetic material through exact reproduction and the potential to adapt by using proteins to build new bodies that might use energy in new ways and in so doing transform energy into more expansive and complex systems. The combination of self-preservation, the way cells productively differentiate themselves from the environment, and adaptability is crucial to relational, social, proto-tactical intelligence. The autopoietic functioning of life is inextricably connected to this relational intelligence. Self-preservation and reproduction of life as an open system that senses and responds to the gradients that it finds itself in is always, on some level, a form of sympoiesis. That is to say, the maintenance of self is always the maintenance of relation. Life is a sympoietic emergence of relational selves from a commons of energy and chemical gradients. As Christopher Miller, writing in the journal Nature, explains, we can see this relational intelligence of life in the proteins that both conserve our bodies and adapt to molecular signaling, enzymes, and atmospheric conditions. Proteins are intelligent beings. They have evolved to operate in the metabolic maelstrom of a turbulent cellular environment. Transcription factors must know when to switch genes on or off. The cellular levels of specific signaling molecules, lactose, retinoic acid, tryptophan and copper, to mention a few cases, give them this information. Likewise, enzymes at key biochemical control points have to speed up or slow down according to the ever-changing demands coded in concentrations of cytoplasmic metabolites of, well, life. Hemoglobin, the granddaddy of all allostoic proteins, knows when you are sleeping or sprinting, realizes whether you live on Cape Cod or in Kathmandu, ascertains moment by moment whether it is coursing through your lungs or visiting vigorously respiring tissue. In Christopher Miller's description of proteins, we can also recognize that part of their intelligence is in the sensing and responding to difference and using energy to produce greater order and complexity in space and time. This mode of intelligence, with its implied quest for energy, drove the development of the early development of bacteria. So this is a little interlude. I just want to go through some of the highlights in the evolution of bacterial technologies in relation to diversity. As Margulis says, bacteria are the main repository of evolutionary diversity. So these are some of the things that bacteria invented: fermentation, nitrogen fixing. So we'll talk a little bit more about those two examples. Photosynthesis, CRISPR gene editing, which is something that is becoming very important in the way that humans are applying that technology. DNA repair, symbiosis, the World Wide Web.
Here I'm talking about a World Wide Web of bacterial DNA information. We'll come back to that. Sex, splitting water into hydrogen and oxygen. This was the photosynthetic bacteria that produced the oxygen that is in our atmosphere, and the nucleated cell. And also at least 20 metabolic modes compared to the two used by plants and animals, which is respiring carbon dioxide and oxygen. So bacteria respire all sorts of crazy stuff, including many metals. Okay, so we'll come to nitrogen fixing in a moment. Actually, I'll just leave that there. One of the early innovations of bacterial life was fermentation, the conversion of sugar to ATP, the chemical energy used within cells for metabolism. The energy storage compound, sorry, this is ATP, is the energy storage compound, the biological coin used by every cell of every living being. That's from What is Life? We can also think of ATP as the energy that allows life to maintain itself in the face of external perturbations. It is the energy that produces greater order and complexity in space and time. It is, on various levels, the fuel of intelligence. Fermentation was a way of producing energy that had some useful byproducts. The fermentation process generally gives the cell a few molecules of ATP for every small food molecule broken down. But it also produced waste that became food for other bacteria, establishing a cyclical processes of energy-releasing carbon transformations. Energy and nutrient flows are central to many stages in microbial contributions to the expanding ecological complexity, including the evolution of bacteria able to fix nitrogen. Nitrogen is an essential part of both the amino acids that make up proteins and the cellular energy of ATP itself. Abiotic sources of nitrogen, such as lightning strikes, can only fix comparatively small amounts of nitrogen. These factors, the fact that they could only fix this small amount of nitrogen, led to a strong evolutionary imperative for the development of nitrogen-fixing bacteria. However, to fix nitrogen takes a prodigious amount of energy, from 6 to 18 molecules of ATP for every molecule of nitrogen. To do this industrially, that is to manufacture plant fertilizer, requires at least 300 times normal atmospheric pressure at 500 degrees Celsius. No plant or animal is capable of this feat. In fact, neither are most microbes. Nitrogen fixing is one of the most metabolically expensive processes in biology. It's hard to overstate the importance of nitrogen-fixing bacteria for multicellular life. Prior to the fixing of nitrogen, there wasn't enough freely available nitrogen for plants and animals to evolve. If we see intelligence as a relational phenomenon in connection with other life forms and gradients, and as something that produces new energy flows, then nitrogen-fixing bacteria are one of the more intelligent life forms that have ever evolved. Without their special skills, there would not have been sufficient nutrient flows to create the macro-scale diversity and complexity that we see around us. Nitrogen fixation is also an interesting example if we imagine the cellular dynamics that might have been involved. We have bacterial cells that already use nitrogen as an essential element in their functioning. They draw that nitrogen from the soup that they are floating in. It is in limited supply. At the same time, there is an abundant, virtually limitless supply of nitrogen in the atmosphere. The bacteria sense this gradient, the difference across the distance between the limited amounts of nitrogen in their cells and the huge amount of nitrogen in the air. The weight of its energetic value to life presses on the bacterial cell to the extent that it reconfigures itself at huge energetic cost to fix nitrogen into a form that its cells and the rest of life can access. Rather than simply benefiting those nitrogen-fixing bacteria, it would seem that the great payoff for all of this energy expended was to become an indispensable symbiont for so many species in the exponential growth in complexity that was partly the result of their nitrogen-fixing innovation. The nitrogen-fixing bacteria displayed powerful relational intelligence that has brought them into close symbiotic relationships with species from several other domains.
an intelligence powerful enough to set a direction for all of life and to ensure that they would remain essential to all life forms to the present day and perhaps for as long as life survives on this planet. Here we might turn to a rather more tangential imagining of the process that produced nitrogen-fixing bacteria. The Three Halves of Ino Moxo by Cesar Calvo is a book in which the narrator offers accounts of a series of ceremonies and meetings with curanderos and ayahuasqueros that led to an encounter with the legendary wizard of the Amazon, Ino Moxo. The question of where this book lies on the spectrum between fiction and factual account is one of several parallels that might be drawn between it and Carlos Castaneda's work. I like to think of the following passage from Calvo's book in relation to nitrogen. I like to think of the following passage from Calvo's book in relation to nitrogen-fixing bacteria. The thoughts of well-meaning people live in the air. They inhabit the air as we do our houses. Before they are placed in books, and only by thinking them, and even if they are never written, they already live in the air. Maestro Ino Moxo revealed to me that ideas are recorded better in the air than they are in notebooks. And pointing to my tape recorder, and they keep better than in those gadgets, because the air belongs to everyone. Perhaps nowadays it's the only thing that belongs to everyone. And without knowing it, without understanding it in our heads, the ideas and souls of ideas that inhabit the air nourish us and encourage us. Maestro Ino Moxo taught me how to read the air, to distinguish and select the thoughts that live in the air. I'm obviously taking a large chunk of poetic license when I suggest that nitrogen fixing was an idea living in the air before it was made concrete by the bacteria that we have been thinking about here. But hopefully you can understand the logic of this intervention within the broader logic of this paper. The evolution of nitrogen-fixing bacteria is an interesting example of the relational factors that might drive the development of particular strains of bacteria, but relational intelligence in the bacterial world goes well beyond individual strains. Bacterial sex involves the direct genetic transfer. Of genetic material via special hookup between free living individuals. Bacteria don't need our rather cumbersome form of meiotic sex to pass on their genes to the next generation. They can do so without reproduction, just by hooking up a cable, and you can see that process in this slide. In this way, bacteria have a kind of World Wide Web of genetic information and use this relational intelligence to evolve in response to their environment. And this skill of bacteria is partly the reason why they're so good at evolving resistance to antibiotics and all of the other stuff that we throw at them. At this point, we return to the trajectories linking prototaxis, symbiosis, and symbiogenesis. Bacteria also display remarkable social intelligence in forging symbiotic relationships with other species. The symbiotic nitrogen-fixing bacteria that legumes rely on have come to produce hemoglobin in concert with the root of the plants. The plant produces the globin protein, while the heme molecule is created by the bacteria. And that's something that you can see here. Obviously, hemoglobin is important in our blood, and you can see that in the plants it's also red. So the hemoglobin moves oxygen from the site of nitrogen-fixing enzymes in the roots that you can see there because oxygen gas will poison these enzymes. In symbiotic relationships, this is what is known as gene-product integration. The co-production of a substance by two species engaged in a symbiotic relationship that is essential to their collective survival. It is another example of relational intelligence operating through both integration and the productive differentiation between organisms. We can continue to trace this trajectory through prototaxis and symbiosis to symbiogenesis, integration between two organisms at the genetic level. The eukaryotic cell is a key example of symbiogenesis. The origin of the nucleated cell was the big question for Lynn Margulis. She speculated that it was formed when a swimming predator bacteria invaded the cell of another individual, but instead of destroying it, took up residence inside the cell and forged a symbiotic and ultimately symbiogenic relationship. All non-bacterial life forms, prototoxists, fungi, plants, and animals, are made from the eukaryotic cells themselves, made from a number of species of previously free-living bacteria. Some organelles inside the eukaryotic cells, which you can see there in the diagram, including plastids and mitochondria, have been unequivocally shown to have once been free-living organisms, and even now maintain their own separate DNA and habits of reproduction. Productive differentiation and relational intelligence is a crucial part of the dynamic of symbiogenesis. Genetic integration doesn't erase difference, but rather it consolidates shared functions and places differences into more intimate and often more productive relationships. It is mitochondria's differentiation, the product of its origin as free-living, oxygen-respiring bacteria, that allows it to provide the essential services of respiration and energy production within the nucleated cell. While the consolidation of shared functions has led it to shed some of its former genes, whose products are now created elsewhere within the cell.